In our study of the book of Joshua, so far, we heard about Joshua fighting the battle against the Canaanites of the hill country, those who went up against the Gibeonites, who had a treaty with Israel. And so there's a whole lot of rest of country that they got to deal with. And I'm sure Joshua was planning a nice campaign, taking them out city-state by city-state, working his way through the whole land of Canaan. Would have been nice and easy had it worked out that way, but it didn't. Joshua chapter 10, down verse 28. Finishing up the southern campaign. Now Joshua captured Makkedah on that day and struck it and its king with the edge of the sword. He utterly destroyed it and every person who was in it. He left no survivor. Thus he did to the king of Makkedah, just as he had done to the king of Jericho. Then Joshua and all Israel with him passed on from Makkedah to Libna and fought against Libna. The Lord gave it also with its king into the hands of Israel, and he struck it and every person who was in it with the edge of the sword. He left no survivor in it. Thus he did to its king, just as he had done to the king of Jericho. And Joshua and all Israel with him passed on from Libna to Lachish, and they camped by it and fought against it. The Lord gave Lachish into the hands of Israel. They captured it on the second day, and struck it and every person who was in it with the edge of the sword, according to all that he had done to Libna. Then Horam, king of Gezer, came up to help Lachish, and Joshua defeated him and his people until he had left no survivor. And Joshua and all Israel with him passed on from Lachish to Eglon, and they camped by it and fought against it. They captured it on that day and struck it with the edge of the sword. And he utterly destroyed that day every person who was in it, according to all that he had done to Lachish. Then Joshua and all Israel with him went up from Eglon to Hebron, and they fought against it. They captured it and struck it and its king and all its cities and all the person who were in it with the edge of the sword. He left no survivor according to all that he had done to Eglon, and he utterly destroyed it and every person who was in it. Then Joshua and all Israel with him returned to Debir, and they fought against it. He captured it and its king and all its cities, and they struck them with the edge of the sword and utterly destroyed every person who was in it. He left no survivor. Just as he had done to Hebron, so he did to Debir and its king, as he had also done to Libna and its king. Thus Joshua struck all the land, the hill country and the Negev and the lowland and the slopes and all their kings. He left no survivor, but he utterly destroyed all who breathed, just as the Lord, the God of Israel, had commanded. Joshua struck them from Kadesh Barnea, even as far as Gaza, and all the country of Goshen, even as far as Gibeon. Joshua captured all these kings and their lands at one time, because the Lord, the God of Israel, fought for Israel. So Joshua and all Israel with him returned to the camp in Gilgal. It's not certain how long that campaign took. We're going to see a little bit further on in the next chapter that the whole campaign of conquest took many years. So it's not certain if it was just a lightning campaign that took a matter of days or weeks, or if all that was describing something that took several years to occur. In chapter 11, then it came about when Jabin, king of Hazor, heard of it, that he sent to Jobab, king of Madon, and to the king of Shimron, and the king of Achshaph, and to the kings who were of the north, in the hill country, in the Arabah, south of Kinneroth, and in the lowland, on the heights of Dor, on the west. The Canaanite on the east and on the west, and the Amorite, and the Hittite, and the Perizzite, and the Jebusite, in the hill country, and the Hivite, at the foot of Hermon, in the land of Mizpah. They came out, they and all their armies with them, as many people as the sand that is on the seashore, with many horses and chariots. So the Canaanites looked at this, and they watched the city-state fall one by one throughout the land of Canaan. They said, whoa, if we just sit here, we're next. So we're going to have to ally together. See, the Canaanites were not one nation. In those days, in the Bronze Age time, you really didn't have one central government. You just had city-states. Each city and its surrounding towns was one area unto itself, kind of like what was happening in ancient Greece, even a little bit later when you had Sparta fighting against Corinth, fighting against Athens, and you had city-states against each other. But when there was a common enemy, they would unite together. In this case, the city-states in Canaan decided, we're either going to join together or we're going to be conquered one by one. Verse 4, they came out, they and all their armies with them, as many people as the sand is on the seashore, with very many horses and chariots. So here we have Joshua and his army, all foot soldiers. And this great army comes out now to meet him, that it's no longer the Israelite army taking out city-state by city-state, but this army from horizon to horizon that's marching down at him. Quite a different situation. So all of these kings, having agreed to meet, came and encamped together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. In those days, chariots, they were like the battle tank. That was the high-tech stuff. You know, when you had a chariot with horses, very hard to stop. If you were just on foot, no armor, with your sword, very hard to stop a chariot coming at you full tilt. So that was the high-tech, a lot of experience, a lot of training to do that, the chariot fighting. So I'm sure Joshua was scared, looking at all this coming at him. Quite a bit different than taking on an individual Canaanite city. Verse 6, and the Lord said to Joshua, do not be afraid because of them. For tomorrow at this time I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire. I was reading up on this. It's like, well, why not preserve and use the chariots? Like God's telling Joshua, you don't need that stuff. You don't need that junk. I'm going to fight for you. Just, you know, get rid of those horses and chariots. Don't save them. Don't use them. You don't need them. Verse 7, so Joshua and all the people of war with him came upon them suddenly by the waters of Merom and attacked them. So rather than waiting for them to attack, Joshua decided to have a surprise attack. Verse 8, the Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel, so that they defeated them and pursued them as far as Great Sidon and Misrephoth Maim in the valley of Mizpah to the east. And they struck them until no survivor was left to them. Joshua did to them as the Lord had told him. He hamstrung their horses and burned their chariots with fire. And Joshua turned back at that time and captured Hazor and struck its king with his sword. For Hazor formerly was the head of all these kingdoms. They struck every person who was in it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was no one left who breathed. And he burned Hazor with fire. It was eventually rebuilt, by the way, because in the book of Judges, in the book of 1 Samuel, once again, we have problems with Hazor, with the Jabin in Hazor. So apparently they didn't do... They might have burnt the city, but they weren't effective at eliminating the threat. Verse 12, Joshua captured all the cities of these kings and all their kings, and he struck them with the edge of the sword and utterly destroyed them, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. However, Israel did not burn any cities that stood on their mounds except Hazor alone, which Joshua burned. All the spoil of these cities and the cattle the sons of Israel took as their plunder, but they struck every man with the edge of the sword until they had destroyed them. They left no one who breathed. Just as the Lord had commanded Moses, his servant, so Moses commanded Joshua, and so Joshua did. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord had commanded Moses. Thus Joshua took all that land, the hill country and all the Negev, all that land of Goshen, the lowland, the Arabah, the hill country of Israel and its lowland, from Mount Halak that rises toward Seir, even as far as Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon and the foot of Mount Hermon, and he captured all their kings and struck them down and put them to death. Joshua waged war a long time with all these kings. See, that's the verse that says that it wasn't... You know, you read through it and you think, oh, this is just a matter of weeks. But this is probably a campaign that took years to accomplish, to finally conquer this city, this country. You might be tempted to think, well, that was cruel that they killed all these kings and all these people. Verse 19, there was not a city which made peace with the sons of Israel except the Hivites, Libyan, Gibeon. They took them all in battle. For it was of the Lord to harden their hearts to meet Israel in battle in order that he might utterly destroy them, that they might receive no mercy, but that he might destroy them, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. And Joshua came at that time and cut off the Anakim from the hill country, from Hebron, from Debir, from Anab, and from all the hill country of Judah, from all the hill country of Israel. Joshua utterly destroyed them with their cities. There were no Anakim left from the land of the sons of Israel, only in Gaza and in Gath and in Ashdod some remained. You know, and then when you get to David's time, we have Goliath, who came from, I believe, Gath. So he was one of the Anakim who was left. It's funny because that was what the spies were afraid of back in the book of Numbers. When they first spied out the land, they said, "Woo, we can't take that. There are Anakim in that land." And for Joshua, it was no problem. He just killed them all. Time to move on. In the power of God, it was not an issue. Verse 23, so Joshua took the whole land, according to all that the Lord had spoken to Moses, and Joshua gave it for an inheritance to Israel according to their division by their tribes. Thus the land had rest from war. And chapter 12, which is just a list of the kings. Now, these are the kings of the land whom the sons of Israel defeated, and whose land they possessed beyond the Jordan toward the sunrise. The valley of the Arnon as far as Mount Hermon, and all the Arabah to the east. Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived in Heshbon and ruled from Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of the Arnon, both the middle of the valley and the gulf and the half of Gilead, even as far as the brook Jabbok, the border of the sons of Ammon. This was even before they entered the land. And the Arabah as far as the Sea of Chinneroth toward the east, and as far as the Sea of the Arabah, even the Salt Sea eastward towards Beth Yeshimoth, and on the south at the foot of the slopes of Pisgah. And the territory of Og, king of Bashan, one of the remnant of Rephaim, who lived at Ashtaroth and at Edrei, and ruled over Mount Hermon and Sarakah and all Bashan, as far as the border of the Geshurites and the Maakathites, and half of Gilead as far as the border of Sihon, king of Heshbon. Moses, the servant of the Lord, and the sons of Israel defeated them, and Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave it to the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh as a possession. Now these are the kings of the land whom Joshua and the sons of Israel defeated beyond the Jordan toward the west. In other words, the campaign that we just read about. From Baal Gad in the valley of Lebanon, even as far as Mount Halak, which rises toward Seir, and Joshua gave it to the tribes of Israel as a possession according to their divisions. In the hill country, in the lowland, in the Arabah, in the slopes, and in the wilderness, in the Negev, the Hittite, the Amorite, and the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. The king of Jericho won, the king of Ai, which is beside Bethel, won. The king of Jerusalem won, the king of Hebron won, the king of Jarmuth won, the king of Rachish won. King of Eglon won, the king of Gezer won. King of Debir won, the king of Gedera won. The king of Hormah won, the king of Adoram won. The king of Machadah won, the king of Bethel won. The king of Tapua won, the king of Hefer won. King of Aphek won, the king of Lasharon won. The king of Madon won, the king of Hazor won. The king of Shimron Meron won, the king of Achshaph won. The king of Tanakh won, the king of Megiddo won. The king of Kadesh won, the king of Yokneam of Carmel won, king of Dor in the heights of Dor won, king of Goyim in Gilgal won, the king of Tirzah won, in all 31 kings, or 31 city-states that the army of Israel was able to take out. They just all fell one by one, or sometime they fell all together when they joined together to fight. All of them. These were strong city-states. I mean, these were things that had troubled the Egyptians for a very long time, and the Egyptians weren't able to take care of this. I mean, the tribes to Egypt's northeast, all these people, they were constant trouble. But as far as God was concerned and the army of Israel, no big deal. No big deal. Just take them out. Start at one end, work to the other. You're done. Unfortunately, we'll find out in a little bit when we get to the further chapters, they didn't eradicate every Canaanite town in the land, and that caused problems later on. I already mentioned that somehow, some way, Hazor got rebuilt so that Jabin and Hazor became an issue in the time of the judges, because probably the sloppy job that was done here. But yet you can see how God was able to make these people and able to have these people triumph over all these kings and all the rest of it. It's kind of, nowadays, a parallel in our time. God doesn't tell us to literally take up a sword and a shield, or, you know, whatever nowadays weapons are, to take up a gun and a bulletproof vest and go after those who don't believe. But rather, nowadays, there is a... The only thing I could think of is the parallel besides the times in our own life. I mean, there's ample parallels in our own life when we go out and we look at a particular issue or a particular problem that God has set before us, and we say, oh, that's too big for me. There's no way I can handle that. And you're probably right. There is no way for you alone to handle that. But rather, God is able to handle that with no problem. If he could have the army of Israel defeat 31 kings, he can take care of that in your life. That's just a snap for God, something he doesn't have to work very hard on, just a real easy problem. And we stress out over it. We just go nuts. We tremble and we shake and we get anxious about things that, as far as God's concerned, are real easy to fix. Maybe He's just leaving it in your life because you have to depend on Him. Maybe He's waiting to fix it. The reason why He's waiting for you to ask Him to fix it. Or maybe you want Him to fix it, and maybe it's something you shouldn't be doing in the first place. You're off doing this, and you're asking God to fix it, but you never asked God's opinion in the first place when you started it. Never asked for God's help. You never asked for what God's thoughts were on it. You just barge right ahead, and now you find yourself in the middle of the enemy's camp, and no idea what to do next. Well, maybe you went the wrong way. Maybe the best solution now is to run. Run hard. Run away. Run someplace else. The other thing I was thinking about that's a parallel to this in the New Covenant and in our day, in our age, is the way the Word of God is managing to get into all the earth. Because when you think about it and you look at that particular battle, I mean, at least Joshua had this huge army. At the point of Yeshua's death and resurrection, he had just maybe, 100 or so people. 120 were gathered together in the upper room after his resurrection. A pitiful small band. But now here we are, 2,000 years later and 2,000 miles away. I don't know exactly, but something like that. Speaking a language that wasn't even invented when the scriptures were written. There was no English language back then. English is a conglomeration of other languages that didn't really form up until after that time. You don't go dig up stones in ancient England from the time of Yeshua written in English. If you're lucky, you might find Latin, but not English. So it's somehow, some way, this little motley band of 120 people managed to carry the message from generation to generation and place to place till it reached us. And drop that into our hands. So we stand at the end of a long chain of people extending back 2,000 years to the time of Yeshua, and even farther than that, all the way back to Moses, and even before that to, in a sense, Jacob, who made his son promise to take his bones back to Canaan because he believed God. But now it's up to us to be faithful and not lose heart. And tell you the truth, there are things that are absolutely daunting. I meant to bring the book with me, but I have it at home. It's a library book. I'll have to remember to copy down the title, but it's about the thinking of 18 to 23 year olds in our current day. And this person went out and surveyed all these 18 to 23 year olds to find out what they think about morality, about what's important in life, about consumerism and all the rest. And there's a reason why you don't see a lot of 18 to 23 year olds in churches. And if we are not careful, this next generation is going to be a really, really terrible one. You can kind of plot on a graph, if we had some sort of fuzzy, multiple dimensional plot of attitudes from the 1940s until today, we can see generally a loosening of moral standards and adherence to moral standards. And in this interview between 18 to 23 year olds, that has certainly continued. A majority of the people that they interviewed have, a strong majority, have really no moral compass at all, nor do they desire one. Nor do they believe that it's proper to judge other people's moral compasses. The majority of them said it was okay to cheat or to lie or even to murder if the situation presented itself. A lot of these people have no idea why there are moral standards or how to set moral standards or how to find moral standards in their life. They have no respect for organized religion. They have no respect for scripture. They have no respect for anybody enforcing any kind of standards on them. And they are the people that we are going to face more and more. They are the people who will craft the institutions and the laws and the organization of society in our elder years. The book wasn't written to be a scary book, but it sure as the dickens scared me. And like Joshua looking out at the army of the Canaanites spread from sea to shining sea, so if we've got sense about us and we look out upon the next generation coming up on us, the temptation is to buy a gun, stock up on groceries, and find a farmhouse somewhere way out in the sticks. Maybe find some like-minded believers, build a very tall fence, put some nice sharp barbed wire on the top, and be set. Maybe raise some chickens, grow some corn. Life is good. But that's not what God calls us to do. He has never called believers to hunker down in a bunker somewhere and load up on the ammo and just pop off anybody who comes in range. That's not what the life of a believer ought to be like. He calls us instead, and we will get to this but a little bit further on, but God explicitly told the Levites that they had no inheritance in Israel, that they were sprinkled around in the cities of the other people. And that's us. We are the priests and kings of this dispensation, and we have been called not to reinforce our fortress somewhere and make our own stronghold, but rather to be out in the power of God in the midst of the trouble, in the midst of the storm. We're the guys and gals with the lanterns out in the middle of the storm. We're not the ones back in the ski lodge. We're the ones out there with the dogs and the lanterns and the flashlights trying to find and rescue people in the midst of the blizzard. That's our calling. I mean, God wasn't subtle about that. He made that really clear when he called us to be his people. And had we had half an eye as believers, if we look back on the history of what happened to believers, we would understand that we weren't being called for a nice, gentle stroll through the amusement park, maybe stopping to buy ice cream from time to time, but that's not what life is like. We are just fortunate to have lived so far in a time and a place that was, although it's had its struggles, it's been at peace, comparatively. I mean, people can say, well, it's not all that peaceful around where I live. Yeah, but nobody's burning down your city. Nobody's carrying you off. Nobody's taking all your stuff. And that's been true in a lot of the history of the world. But we've been called not to hunker down, not to clasp our hands tightly over our eyes and somehow manage still to stuff our thumbs in our ears and crouch under something heavy and hope it all goes away, because it's not going to go away, and that's not our calling. We have to be out there. The reason why this generation that's coming up, 18 through 23-year-olds, is so much into moral relativism and consumerism is because we have not done our job. The churches have not done our job, and we, as in particular as believers, have not done our job in passing on to the next generation the things of God. So we are off doing whatever as a people and not caring about what's going on with the kids and somehow giving them the message that morality doesn't matter. It's been taught in the public schools. It's been heard from some pulpits. It's certainly been true in popular culture. You look at the movies that they watch. It's like the hero is somebody who would be a particularly slimy villain in movies when I was growing up, and he's the hero. And in some of these movies, it's about criminals doing criminal things to other criminals, and you walk away saying, what was the point of that? But God has called us to go out and win the victory. And He has empowered us to do so. Start small. If every believer... I mean, we look at the state of our government and the state of our culture. Election years are bad for that. Because you look at the candidates, and you look at what they're saying, and all the rest of it, and the sniping and all the rest, and your skin starts to crawl a little bit. But we can't do anything to change that. In fact, the way Maryland is, yeah, I start finding myself sometimes getting upset over the primaries and who's winning and who's losing, and then it occurs to me there's nothing I can do about it. In fact, in a particular state we live in Maryland, the things are set up so that by the time the primaries come to Maryland, it's too late. I mean, we're one of the last primary states, and by that time the race is decided. So we really don't have any say, so it's best to just sit back and enjoy the circus and don't worry about it too much, because you can't do anything to change it. What we can change, what we can do is the people around us. We can minister to the people around us. We can be that voice in our workplaces, in our neighborhoods, in our families. We can write letters. We can post on the internet. We can email. We can, do web pages. You can do whatever in order to be that light to people that we can affect, the people that we can do things about. And who knows what God can do? Who knows what God is capable to accomplish through the very few that are devoted to Him? He's always shown Himself able to do things that little group had never imagined to begin with. Things happen when God gets involved. The less adept, less technologically equipped army winds up defeating the stronger. The few defeat the many. God takes a nation that's very far from Him, and revival starts in a strange place, some out of the way little town, and spreads to the whole country. It's happened before in this nation, before now. I mean, you look at what things are like in the late 1800s, and things are pretty dire, morally speaking, and things happened. God can do work today. But just like He took the land of Canaan through the instrument of Joshua's army, so when He turns a culture right side up, He uses His people. And we have got to be willing to be used to be part of this when it starts to happen. It might happen in our lifetime. It may never happen here again. Revival may not happen in America. It might break out in some other country, some other place, where believers here might be just spectators. I can't say. Nobody can say. But I do know that God's power is available to us to do the things that He has called us to do. And what He's called us to do is to be His representatives, and to be pure, and to be those priests and kings, no matter what's going on, all around us, and not to be stirred up or beaten down, but to always look up and trust in that God whose power is boundless. Let's pray. Dearest God and Father, I thank You for the great testimony that we have and what You're able to accomplish through Joshua's army. Sometimes we feel like we're just one or two against armies of our own, but Father, we know that You're able to win the battle through us, that our victory doesn't rest in our own skill or our own character, but rather the victory rests in You, that You are able to accomplish Your plan no matter what, that You even use the schemes of the wicked to accomplish Your plans. Father, continue to point out to us in so very many ways Your power and Your principles and Your plan, so that we would not be knocked over by events all around us, but that we might stand tall, waiting in joyful hope for the return of our Messiah, Yeshua. Amen.